You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Anna Sale in for Leonard Lopate today. The United States and Mexican security services have forged an unparalleled relationship in recent years in the fight against drug cartels. But as President Obama prepares for his upcoming trip south of the border, a series of policy changes in Mexico signal that cooperation in the war on drugs, as it exists now, may be in jeopardy. We're joined now by Washington Post national security reporter Donna Priest. She recently wrote about this issue, and we've provided a link to her article on our show page at WNYC.org. She's also the co-author of the book Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. And I'm pleased to welcome her back to the Leonard Lopate Show. Hello.
Hi, nice to be here, Anna.
So you write that the United States and Mexico have developed an unparalleled alliance in the war on drugs. Let's talk first about what that has looked like. What U.S. agencies have been involved? What's that cooperation looked like?
Well, it's involved the DEA, the Department of Drug Enforcement Agency, and the CIA, and the immigration authorities, the FBI. Really, there's a dozen departments and agencies that work closely with the Mexicans. It's not been an easy relationship to establish. It happened over the last 10 years, but in particular the last 6 or 7, it got very intense. It involves the most sensitive things that I wrote about involve the working together of the DEA and its special units that it designates in Mexico, and the CIA with its specially trained units that it trains and equips to go out on raids and to take down drug kingpins. That's the strategy that they were pursuing, to find and capture or kill the drug kingpins. Now, to find them meant creating an entirely different way of operating, to share intelligence with the Mexicans in a very quick way, sort of like what we did in Iraq and Afghanistan when troops went after the high-value targets there, the suspected terrorists. So we had to build an infrastructure. We had to build a way to share that information. The U.S. had to vet the units that they would and the people that they would share that with, because corruption is just so rampant in Mexico, and there was a major problem with information leaking to the cartels who had bought their way into law enforcement. It also involved a lot of trust on the Mexicans' part, because they have great suspicions about the United States. They don't want the U.S. to dominate the relationship. They are particularly wary of the military, which has invaded their country before. And so it was a very, like, step-by-step thing. But President Felipe Calderon, who decided, because the drug violence had gotten so bad by the mid-2000s, decided to use the military to help fight the drug cartels, asked the United States to help. And that was under President Bush, and President Bush said yes. They started that pretty quickly. They passed a lot of sensitive signals intelligence, you know, intercepts. They used U.S. spy planes to gather intelligence. They eventually used unarmed drones from the Customs and Border Patrol. Then they went, on the border, and then they went deeper into Mexico. Those drones would either go after particular people, or else they would try to establish pattern of life patterns where they could identify somebody doing something suspicious. But they also gave them electronic signals technology, ground sensors, voice recognition gear, a lot of technology to track cell phones, and then to crunch all that data, not only cell phone, but things that you would capture from a raid, the hard drives, the thumb drives, the computers themselves, a lot of data analysis tools and computer hacking kits that would allow them to get the entire sort of digital exhaust of any cartel member, high or low. And so it really did become a very deep relationship with the CIA, with the DEA, between Treasury and their department. And then along comes a new president, and the old party that had ruled in Mexico for 70 years and not for the last 15 years came back into power, and that's
right.
when things changed.
That's when things changed. But before we get to that election, I want to make sure we sort of fully understand the dynamics as they were, because mm-hmm. your piece just lays out, I mean, how extensive this relationship had become over a series
right.
of years. And you mentioned that Mexican trust was very much required, and that this intelligence gathering was largely adopted from some of our anti-terror, counter-terror intelligence. So who was in charge, given, like, who was the architect of this intelligence gathering operation?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was the country team down in the embassy working with the Mexicans, but eventually under the Bush administration, where it really did deepen quite a bit, because Vicente Fox, the president, the first non-pre-president, was elected. He sort of opens the way. Then 9/11 happens, and the Americans put a lot of pressure on the Mexicans, and the Mexicans say, "We understand this is a major issue for you. We will help you," and they do a lot on the border that they hadn't been doing before. One of the most interesting things that they do there is they come up with a protocol under which Mexican authorities detain a non-Mexican from a country of interest for the United States, a place where, you know, terrorists are known to have come from, and the U.S. is worried they're going to come across the border. And they allow the Americans to interrogate them remotely, not where they are, but maybe from the United States. And they do a lot of other things. They shore up their oil platforms, and they open this sort of idea that we're going to give them intelligence, they're going to use it to do operations, we're going to help them do operations. And that starts an intelligence cycle, as the professionals would call it, that is very important to when the war on drugs becomes a dominant theme. So you move from 9/11, where things were getting closer, into the mid-2000s, where the violence was just getting so out of hand, and you had, I'm sure you remember, the beheadings and multiple people
yes.
hung, and really people being tortured by the cartels, in part because the military goes after the cartels with our help. We are helping to plan those operations. We are also helping to direct them remotely, but we aren't on the ground with the Mexicans doing the operations, and that's something the Mexicans just, you know, refuse to have us right there. The CIA has another program codenamed Scenic, which is an effort to take some Mexicans, a small Mexican unit, and train them better in intelligence gathering on their own. And the relationship with the CIA had actually gone back many years to the Cold War, when the CIA was very abundant in Mexico because the Russians and the Chinese had a big presence there. So 9/11 opens the door more, and then you see Calderon being desperate to fight these cartels. As they make progress, as they start to take out the kingpins, you now have a power vacuum in the cartels, and the cartels are fighting one another, and that's when this huge increase in violence, mostly related to cartel members or their families, but still, it's just gigantic. 60,000 people have died since the mid-2000s in Mexico, and another up to 25,000 have disappeared from the violence that comes as a result of the attack against the cartels and the cartel on cartel violence.
So the violence as a result of the attack on the cartels, I'm speaking to Washington Post national security reporter Donna Priest about U.S.-Mexican security relations. So do you believe it's been effective if taking out the top kingpins led to this chaos that led to more violence prior to the election and prior to this, what looks to be a reevaluation of the strategy? Do you think it was working?
Well, it worked for the short-term goal, which was to try to begin to weaken the cartels. But if you look at the importation of illicit narcotics, no, it hasn't made a huge dent in that.
So it neither decreased violence nor decreased importation of drugs.
It increased violence because the cartels were going after one another. It did not decrease drugs. I mean, the government will argue, well, it would have been worse. And the cartels were gaining so much territory that it was creating political instability in Mexico. The institutions of the Mexican government were becoming as corrupt almost as in Colombia back two decades ago. And that's where, you know, you risk the state falling apart. Now, it hadn't gotten that bad, but it was on its way to getting that bad. So the U.S. government and the Mexican government didn't want to do nothing, and they wanted to do something very quick or relatively quick. But unfortunately, as we've seen in the entire drug war for two decades, it doesn't, if you do, it has not decreased the sale, the trade. It really hasn't. And that is for many factors, but principally because the demand is here. It's so lucrative. And when you cut off one route to the United States, as the U.S. did in the Caribbean in the late 80s and early 90s, it stopped the flow through the Caribbean to the United States from Colombia, where most of the cocaine is made. And that pushed it to Mexico. So it's that balloon effect that they always talk about. And that's why Mexico became such a problem. So in the big scheme of things, no, it didn't have an effect. It's so far failed to make headway in this long and expensive and bloody war on drugs.
I want to also ask you about drones. There was some conversation about armed drones at one point. Mm. Now there are unarmed drones. What is in place now, and what's been the conversation about how to use them?
There have only been unarmed drones in Mexico. They started, the first drone strike was in, sorry, not drone strike, the first drone flight was in 2009 when a Border Patrol agent was killed in a robbery.
And during the Obama administration then.
Right. And they asked the Mexicans, can we fly a drone to try to find these culprits? The Mexicans said yes. It worked out. In other words, the U.S. didn't take over, which I think the Mexicans were worried about. By that time, drones had gotten such a bad rap. And these are surveillance drones. They're not armed. So that door got cracked open, and the Mexicans felt comfortable enough to let it keep opening, and they allowed the U.S. to fly surveillance drones deeper into the country on specific missions. In part, they allowed it because the Americans allowed the Mexicans to control it. So you had an American pilot based in the United States flying a drone remotely, but a Mexican commander on the ground who could tell that American pilot where to go within a particular grid, they call it, that is a pre-designated area, and what to look for. Well, the Mexicans learned, like other people have, that this is a very effective surveillance tool, so they started buying drones from overseas and developing their own. And now they're flying many more of their own drones than they can get the U.S. to fly. In the process, as the violence continued and didn't get better, Calderon got desperate, and he asked the White House for armed drones, which he had been reading about in the paper as having been a key tool in killing individual terrorists overseas in the war on terror. The White House considered it, but it was really, they did so as a courtesy, but there was no way they were going to allow that. You know, for one thing, most of these cartel members operate in populated cities, and the collateral damage would be just way too much. And I think also the U.S. would be very worried about their reputation. Already drones is a very sensitive subject for a lot of people. So that did not go through, but Calderon asked again under Obama, under his administration. He became, again, so desperate to make headways against the cartels.
And then there was the election, which we will talk about in just a moment. I'm speaking with Donna Priest, national security reporter for The Washington Post, about the unprecedented cooperation between U.S. and Mexican security agencies in the fight against drug cartels and how that could be changing. We'll have more after a break. And also coming up later in the show, Christine Barnett talks about her son Jacob, who's a math genius who many think could one day win the Nobel Prize in Physics. He's also autistic. She'll talk about the unexpected challenges of raising a brilliant child. Plus, sports broadcaster Claire Balding on growing up in a different kind of unusual household. Her father was one of Britain's premier horse trainers and ran a farm that was home to more than 100 horses. I'm Anna Sale in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Anna Sale in for Leonard Lopate today. We're speaking with Donna Priest from The Washington Post about the unprecedented cooperation between the U.S. and Mexican security agencies in the fight against drug cartels. And we're taking a look at how that could be changing. There's been a recent election in Mexico, and the Mexican government has announced that the Interior Ministry will now coordinate the relationship between Mexican and U.S. agencies. So, Donna, how big of a change would this be?
Well, you know, it's the outlines are not totally drawn in yet, but U.S. officials really fear that a lot of the cooperation is going to be scaled back, in part because of the way, well, can you imagine, you know, you aren't running the country, so you really don't know what's going on. And then you get elected, you come into office, your transition team goes to the embassy, which is what happened here. All the security team was called to the U.S. embassy on December 15th to meet with the U.S. embassy team who had been involved in all the things that I'd been describing to give them a briefing on it. And according to people who understand what happened there, you know, the Mexicans were very stone-faced, but they think they were pretty shocked to all of a sudden learn of how deep this cooperation was.
This transition team coming into office not realizing the extent to which this cooperation has been going on.
Exactly. And they represent the PRI and the president, the new president, Enrique Peña Nieto, who has a different view during the campaign. He campaigns against the violence, and in that way, he's campaigning against Calderon's strategy of going after mm-hmm. the kingpins and going after the cartels. So the administration here is already worried because they think if you want to get rid of the violence, if you want to decrease the violence, that in essence means you're going to not be going after the cartels in the same way, because they do think more violence for a period of time is going to be necessary to weaken them, not, you know, years, but more. So they hear the campaign rhetoric, and then they see the surprise, and then the new administration starts to talk about reorganizing everything and centralizing it, which the PRI was known for anyway. It's a more authoritarian type of centralized government anyway. And so now, instead of having the DEA with its relationship, the CIA with its relationship, which was a little chaotic, they want to centralize it all into the Interior Ministry, who would then delegate the more tactical operations and relationships to the Mexican intelligence agency. Now, they want to also create a whole new way of bringing intelligence together, including intelligence from the United States, with these five fusion centers, if you will, around the country. Well, those are going to need new people, and those people haven't been vetted. And so the whole problem, this kicks back the whole problem of information that gets leaked to the bad guys. And the U.S. has spent a lot of time vetting particular people on these units, and all those people, every single individual, has to be vetted for human rights violations also because of the Leahy Amendment. And so now they're going to be dealing with a whole group of people they don't know, they aren't necessarily going to trust, and they're not going to share intelligence with people who they haven't vetted. So you can see a standoff coming. Already the number of cartel members who have been pursued has decreased, and so has the number of extraditions from Mexico to the United States. And I have to say, Mexico's judicial system is just totally broken. It has a 2% prosecution rate. So the only way to follow up on the arrest of cartel members there is for them to be extradited to the United States.
So you mentioned that U.S. authorities are worried about a change in strategy. President Obama addressed this at his press conference yesterday. Let's take a listen.
We've made great strides in the coordination and cooperation between our two governments over the last several years. But my suspicion is that things can be improved. And some of the issues that he's talking about really have to do with refinements and improvements in terms of how Mexican authorities work with each other, how they coordinate more effectively. And it has less to do with how they're dealing with us, per se.
So you have President Obama saying there that things can be improved. Last night, Mexico announced that it had captured the father-in-law of the most wanted kingpin known as El Chapo. Is this partially Mexico trying to demonstrate that they can be effective and let us kind of figure out our strategy and we're going to keep arresting people as we do it?
It could, and that would be the best outcome. The administration doesn't really have much leverage, so they are not going to start criticizing the Mexicans. They're going to be very patient, hope that the more they learn about what the relationship really entailed, and to work with them through their effort to reorganize and take them at their word that they're trying to do a better job, then, you know, hopefully the one-on-one relationships that are so crucial to this will develop, and they'll see that the United States is not trying to take this process over. They may also understand how valuable U.S. intelligence is. The fact is that the DEA has a better on-the-ground human, as the intelligence agency calls it, human source network, informants, than the Mexicans do. And they have a large presence in Mexico. That's by design and with the Mexicans' approval, and because so many people have ties back to the United States, and they make arrests in the United States, they are able to do deals with people to become informants. So they actually have a very sophisticated, deep level informant base that, again, the Mexicans don't necessarily have, particularly because the corruption is the thickest at the local and state level where these sorts of informants come from. So you can't expect in Mexico the local and state police to do much of this work because they're often in cahoots with the drug dealers. So the U.S. is going to take the attitude, you know, we'll be patient, just don't close the door on us, we'll help, we'll do whatever we can. The Mexicans want to train a entirely new 10,000-person gendarmerie, they call it, just sort of like a super police in order to get the military eventually off the streets. The U.S. is more than willing to help out. Mexicans so far have said, no, this is going to have no U.S. fingerprints on it. And they've also asked the Americans to leave one of the fusion centers that they're now in and help set up in Monterey.
So how big a deal is that? I mean, let's lay out what these fusion centers have been, because you have described this sort of setup where intelligence gathering has been largely designed by sort of U.S. strategies, and then the U.S. supplies the technical, you know, requirements and equipment on the ground to Mexicans to gather that intelligence. How does that fit in with these fusion centers? What has been going on there, and how much does it matter that Americans are leaving Monterey now?
Well, you remember what the U.S. went through after 9/11, with part of the problem being the FBI, the CIA wouldn't share with each other, the local authorities, same thing. Well, it's, you know, five times worse in Mexico. The Army doesn't trust the Navy, the federal police. There's no way that they want to work, you know, side by side with either one of those. And then the state and local police are so corrupt, nobody will work with them. So part of what Mexico is trying to do is to change that by saying, okay, in these fusion centers, all of you have to come together, just like we have here at the National Counterterrorism Center. And they're trying to force that change. The problem is no one in the U.S. side, well, they think that'll be a long haul. So what do you do in the meantime when you're setting up fusion centers with a lot of mistrust among the people in them? And, you know, the whole point is to share. Well, share what? They have a fusion center right now, and it's pretty much a joke because some of the agencies, the Mexican agencies, the critical ones, don't participate in it because they don't want to share any information with anybody else. And so they get very low-level, uninteresting information. I asked the question, well, what could the Mexicans, do they have enough sources, do they have the coordination, the skill, and the experience to, you know, carry off raids on their own? And the answer was, well, yeah, it'll be slower and fewer, but there are units that know how to do this. They just are, it just will be very much slower and fewer arrests. Now, the Mexicans also want to take what I think is a more holistic approach, because the killing of the kingpins is what gets so much attention. And it's an approach the U.S. definitely would back, but it doesn't produce results right away. One part of it is to go after the middlemen, the logistics and the financiers and the people that really matter to whether a cartel can continue to thrive. Because you can take off the leadership and then some other leader will come on. But if you get rid of all the people in the middle that make the distribution and collection of drugs happen, then it's a little harder. And they want to work at the bottom level to, build up the social base to prevent people from joining the cartels. And that is obviously so important, but also a very long-term goal. So if they are able to do those things too, plus work on the judicial system, because you can't, I mean, nothing.
You have to be able to prosecute.
One person said it's like a vacuum cleaner with no bag. you scoop all these people up, you put them in jail, they either leave jail eventually or they just sit there with no prosecution.
So would this new strategy mean a less militarized approach?
Eventually, that's the idea. Nobody disagrees with that. You know, the military, Calderon used it because he didn't have a big enough federal police and he couldn't use the state and local police. So he did call on the military, which is seen as more professional than any other force that Mexico would have. But nobody likes that because they're trained to use maximum violence rather than minimal force. And many other reasons. They're just the military, and citizens don't like that. But Peña Nieto made a big deal about that during the campaign. So right now he hasn't brought troops back into the barracks because he realizes, his people say, that there isn't anything to replace them. So the idea is this 10,000 person gendarmerie, which they say will be stood up by the end of the year, although it hasn't even begun yet. They are going to slowly replace the military, who will go back to the barracks. And that is a good theory. I think a lot of people would like to have that happen, and in many countries, including the U.S., will do whatever they are permitted to do to help that become a possibility.
So this is a rethinking of kind of the entire strategy. Should we think of this as, I mean, you described the intelligence gathering as sort of being modeled on some of the counterterror, you know, the work against Al-Qaeda, that became applied to what was happening with the drug cartels in Mexico. Should we think of this rethinking of strategy as some sort of indication that model wasn't a good one for what was happening in Mexico?
I think that the new president thinks that it was not a good model because of the violence that came with it. And he is trying to come up with a better model. A lot of people didn't like the model. Even people within the administration will say, if we could have found something better that would have not caused so much violence, that first of all, they were surprised by the level of violence, then you know, they definitely would have done it. Nobody thinks this has ended up, the violence has just, you know, torn Mexico apart and sullied their relationship with the rest of the world. People are afraid to travel there, you know, the whole thing. So I think it was the worst of all, or the best of all evils in terms of how to deal with this. And so people do look for a different solution, but they've also thought a lot of this through and don't really think there's a great solution. Now, the worry is that what it amounts to is an unspoken truce with the cartels. You know, if you stop the violence, we won't pressure you like we were before. And then you have presumably an increase in the amount of drugs coming through the border.
That brings me to, there's a detail in your story that I just kind of had to read a few times in terms of where there are truces with the cartels. You mentioned that at one point the CIA proposed electronically emptying the bank accounts of drug kingpins, but that was turned down by the Treasury Department and the White House because they feared unleashing chaos in the banking system.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a tactic they were not willing to do, and in some ways were willing to look the other way at the bank accounts? Is that
well,
how we should...
not look the other way, but to take a longer road at trying to stop money laundering, which is also a critical part of the trade. And the idea is if you can take away the money, then it will fall apart. But it's hard to take away the money because tracing it is difficult. We've had some high-profile cases recently, HSBC Bank in Mexico, and they settled with the bank because they thought the process They thought that bringing a prosecution would be too difficult. There are complicated cases. They take a long time. But everybody agrees that stopping the flow of money and being able to launder the money is so crucial. So one obvious method to do that is a cyber war method. But just like in the larger discussion on offensive cyber, the reason why the government doesn't do that very often is that it could unleash either a backlash that is huge, or it could have unintended effects. In other words, you think that you're only taking out, you know, cartel member X's bank account, but actually it's, you can't be that precise, and you end up making disappear a lot of other people's accounts. So it's not a fine art yet to really be able to say, you know, exactly how this is going to turn out. And so they just, didn't want to go there.
And just in our last 30 seconds, Donna, I want to ask you about, you said that there was the Americans have little leverage in this right now. The Obama administration has little leverage. Senator Patrick Leahy is holding up the latest installment of $246 million to Mexico. It's the latest installment of what's called the Merida Initiative. Do we have leverage in terms of money that goes to Mexico, supplies, technical know-how? Is that leverage that we do have to make sure?
You know, I've probably been in Washington so long that I'm going to say that's peanuts in terms of the amount of money involved. Merida isn't that large. It's about $1.9 billion over the years that it's existed. And it's more symbolic. Well, it's more than symbolic. I mean, there is a transfer of equipment that's been really important. But by now, the Mexicans, you know how to do some of this by themselves without that. So the money is not that much money.
That's not leverage. That's peanuts, you say.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I've been speaking with Donna Preece, national security reporter for The Washington Post. We've been discussing the unprecedented cooperation between the U.S. and Mexican security agencies in the fight against drug cartels. We have a link to Donna's reporting on our show page at WNYC.org. Donna, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.